So I'll talk about recent results from high-res. That is the word stereo here. I've always been of the opinion that we should stress more the results from high-res stereo because that's our best data set. So I mainly focus on results from high-res stereo. Well, it's only yesterday that I became aware of the fact that there are a lot of theorists here. So I noticed that Stefan Stolk already has the word declassified in the data.
I know.
This is at the beginning, you realize, of the summer, so a lot of things that will be announced at the Cosmic Ray Conference in August will not be in this talk yet. Looking a little bit ahead of what's coming up this week, for example, the talk by Glenn Sfarai will put some more emphasis on studies of anisotropy because that's what you will talk about too, and there are some controversies here that we can deal with on Thursday. Okay, so let's look at the participants in the Harris experiment first. It's a collaboration, mainly American institutions, Utah, Columbia, and Rutgers are the three biggest ones. That's also New Mexico, Montana, Adelaide. Los Alamos National Laboratory joined after September 11 and has played a crucial role in keeping this experiment going because, as you know, high-res is at the Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah, and access to this site was suspended after September 11. And it was people from Los Alamos Lab who have military clearance who kept the experiment running during a very crucial period of time in 2002. The status right now is that American citizens are allowed back on the site and can take shifts. Non-Americans like myself cannot go there. We are taking HIRES 1 shifts remotely from three of these institutions, Utah, Columbia, and Rutgers. We can run the HIRES 1 detector remotely. So it's basically opening doors and starting the detector that you can do from your laptop. So here's an outline of the talk. I'll briefly introduce the HIRES experiment, talk about the current status of the HIRES theory data set, which will be the basis of results presented here and later at the Cosmic Ray Conference. And then I will focus on some searches for anisotropies, basically two-point correlation sky maps that will lead into Glennis's talk on Thursday, about 40 eV and about 10 eV. Then some topic that has become somewhat important over the last half year or so. I'd like to straighten out any rumors that are floating around about this particular correlation with Via-like objects. So I'll talk in length about this. I'll also talk about the chemical composition at the time at the end. I can go into the molecular spectrum and we can discuss that. So let me start with pointing out a couple of recent journal publications. HIRES is not known for its huge body of publications, but we have gone better over the last year. There are a large number of publications out there now, which you can check out. These are stereo publications that you can see. They basically cover the central point sources and small scale anisotropy and the composition of cosmic rays. In preparation, coming out in about a month or so, is a paper that deals with the cross correlations of cosmic rays and Via-like objects. And just to be complete, here are the 2004-2005 model publications. They basically deal with the spectrum and also with topics related to anisotropy of cosmic ray arrival directions. So you all know how this kind of detector works, but I would like to show this kind of simulation that comes from Heiner Drescher, who's in Frankfurt right now. You would see here now there's a cosmic ray coming in, photon coming in over here. This is, at the time he was at NYU, so I always think it's kind of Manhattan here in New Jersey over here, so it gives you a feeling of the range. And then, of course, what happens is that this event produces a shower, and we have about 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 10 or so particles. And I always show that because my colleagues at RIC always show their event space, and they're very, very complicated, and I like to show this to say, you know, we have to reconstruct the properties of this particle coming in over here from this, and we don't even see this. We see, well, either what hits the ground, or we see the fluorescence light of this shower development.
And it's going off at high angles, what are those?
Well, these are just, so these are muons, these are gammas and electrons, you see the electron curve here.
Except sorry, yeah, these are... This is not going to do good because it looks
right.
Like it's a daytime.
Right, this is just the full,
the full
show.
This is the big one.
Oh, this can be, these are gammas and electrons. So it would go off.
The gammas are, the numbers have to be collimated, so the triangles.
Right. The, I don't know the color code. I think the electrons are.
The light blue is going up.
Yeah.
It's not
that's
scale.
I think
those are gamma photons.
I think they're photons.
Optical origin
right.
as well. Right?
Yeah. I mean, this is a this is not what we see. It's everything. So the detection techniques. I was just in one slide go over that. You can either sample the shower at the ground, which is what the gas on the ground array of Auger is doing. Or you can observe the shower as it develops in the atmosphere. It excites nitrogen molecules, which fluoresce back in the ultraviolet. And you can observe this ultraviolet light and see the shower development in the atmosphere with photomultiplier tubes. Obviously, this kind of experiment, the higher experiment, can only operate on clear moonless nights, so the atmospheric conditions are good. That's one of the reasons why the detector is in Utah, in a very dry desert atmosphere. That means that we have a duty cycle of only about 8 to 10% of the surface detector, but at any given instant when the detector is running, the detector volume we're probing for these kind of showers going down in the atmosphere is very, very large, about 10,000 square kilometers at 10 to 20. So once again, how does the technique work? The shower comes down over here, emits fluorescence light. That light gets focused in a mirror and reflected back in a photomultiplier camera. Here are a couple of pictures. This is one of the high-res two huts containing two of these mirror PMT cluster combinations. These are the mirrors of about 4 or 5 square meter area. The light comes in, gets reflected into this camera over here. The camera is shown in the reflection of the mirror over here. It's 16 by 16 photomultiplier tubes, each of which covers about 1 degree by 1 degree field of view. They're hexagonal in shape. And the camera itself looks like this. There's a filter which is now turned down here, which goes in front of these tubes, which keeps out a large fraction of the optical light. So this is the UV filter over here. This is a typical event that goes through 4 of these cameras. Starts over here. There's no gap in between here, it's just for this display. So the shower comes down over here. And the energy and the direction of the shower can be reconstructed from this image in the photomultiplier camera. Now, HIRES is a stereo detector. That means it has two of these sites. The HIRES 1 site is the older of the two sites. It consists of 22 telescopes. Each of them has 16 by 16, meaning 256 photomultipliers. It covers 360 degrees in azimuth and about 3 to 16 and a half degrees in elevation. You can see that over here in this artist's view of an event. HIRES 2 is the newer site. It's about 13 kilometers away from HIRES 1. It has about twice as many telescopes, which means that it covers a larger elevation range. So there's 2 rows of these 16 by 16 cameras, so it covers 3 to 30 degrees in elevation above the horizon. Also roughly 360 degrees, there's a small gap here because there's a little a gap in that ring. So, HIRES 2 also has a flash ADC system, which HIRES 1 does not have. So let me briefly go over the status of HIRES 1 as of, HIRES Stereo as of now. The HIRES 1 detector has been taking data from June 1997 to the present. HIRES 2 was built a little bit later, started data taking November 1999, so we have stereo data from November 1999 to the present. That, as of April 2005, means about 3,000 hours of stereo exposure, roughly 10,000 stereo event candidates, and 6,500 reconstructed stereo events at all energies. That does not mean that these events will eventually show up in a spectrum. These are the energies of these events. So this is a distribution of the energy of these 6,505 events. As I said, quality cuts are not yet included in this number over here, so they'll maintain this part over here as the number of events we have above, say, 100 eV. This is a rough overview of how many events we have right now above given energy thresholds. I put a to be announced at the highest energies. As you can see from this plot, it's of the order of 3 or 4 events that we have about 10 to the 20 electron volts. So there's no doubt that these events exist, but as you will also later see when you look at the high-res molecular spectrum, we do not see the continuation of the spectrum as it's seen by AGASA.
These are mono numbers?
No, this is stereo. This is all stereo.
Stereo.
Yeah.
It's stereo. So you have many more mono events?
Yes.
How many do you have?
I'm not aware how many monocular events you have in one right now. I don't know the number by hand.
Roughly, but what the factor would be?
I guess it would be a factor of 2.
Okay.
So, the detector cell is scheduled to take data through March 2006, so that brings us to the end of the winter period where our viewing conditions are best. So, why stereo? Well, if you can see better with two eyes, you can, with your eyes, you can also see better. We can start shots better with two fluorescence detectors. So, this is the shower axis, and the shower comes on over here. You immediately get the shower detector plane when you're trying to reconstruct the shower, which is the plane that contains the shower and the detector. However, if you only have a monocular view of the shower, it is very difficult to decide where in this plane the shower is actually situated and located. So, one angle in monocular view is very well reconstructed. That's the angle that is given by the shower detector plane. Another one is not, which is the angle that this shower has in this plane. So, however, if you have stereo view, you can of course take either the cross section of these two areas and get a very good estimate of the air shower trajectory. That's not what's done. What actually is done is we do a global taxpayer minimization that uses not only these two planes, but also the timing information, so it's a very global fit that uses all the available information in these tubes. Keep in mind also that with using stereo reconstruction, the otherwise very crucial dependence on atmospheric parameters is somewhat reduced, because you will get quite different estimates of the energy from each of the two sites if you separate, if you fit them separately, if your atmosphere is wrong under the shower, and the shower has a different distance to each of these sites. So the correction we do for atmospheric parameters, of course, depends on the distance of the shower to the detector. If that distance is very different and the correction is wrong, then you will get different energies from site A and site B, and you know that there is a problem. So, about the annual resolution, high-res currently provides us with the sharpest image of the northern sky. It's quite an improvement over the AGASA ground array. As you can see over here, which it's a plot that shows a fraction of events that have a reconstructed direction, so this is simulation, with an angular distance delta to the true direction, less than this angle, you see that this fraction is about 68% or so at the reconstructed, a difference between the reconstructed and the true error of 0.6 degrees. So 68% of the events are reconstructed within 0.6 degrees of the true arrival direction. As for the systematic error, one of the things we can do is check from star surveys and lasers the systematic error, and we estimate that this is not larger than 0.2 degrees, mainly caused by uncertainties in the mirror pointing. This is just one slide concerning this mirror pointing issue. Of course, these photomanipulators look into the night sky, so what they will occasionally see, if you plot the variance of the tubes as a function of time, are these little bumps. There's a nicer one over here. And that is when a star crosses the field of view. And this analysis of stars and the time they cross the field of view, of course, allows you to check whether your telescope is pointing into the correct direction. So it's kind of a calibration tool. Not only that, it also allows you to estimate what a point source would look like in the detector. So for example, this is the image of a star as a function of angular distance to the center. And you can, for example, see effects like if you go out in the mirror, you're more to the rim of the mirror, this point spread function that you can estimate from a star increases in width. So stars are a very good tool both to check the systematic error that comes from a wrong pointing. They allow us to monitor the pointing over a longer period of time, and they allow us to estimate the point spread function of the instrument as a function of position on the mirror.
How good is your pointing?
Well, as I said, the systematic error on the pointing will be roughly 0.1 to 0.2 degrees.
Yeah.
So the angular resolution shown here once again for showers at 10 eV energy has only a slight dependence on zenith and azimuth angle. As you can see over here, it's both the scatter plot of the angular resolution of the distance between true and reconstructed shower direction for 10 eV Monte Carlo showers, and this line over here marks the median. So you see that the dependence on zenith angle and on azimuth angle is marginal. It rises here at about 60 degrees or so. We have a zenith angle cut in our analysis of about 70 degrees, but you see that still over here, the angular resolution of about 1.2 degrees is still considered better than the 2.5 degrees for the Agassiz ground rate, for example. This little spike over here is actually the point where the two detectors for the shower line are in the line. So stereo reconstruction, of course, breaks down, and you basically see that. And the char detector planes that you can start are actually basically identical. So there are a couple of quality cuts that I won't go into. Anisotropy studies that will follow now, we apply a 70 degree zenith angle cut, and we have cuts on the chi-square of the event. As far as weather cuts go, as long as the weather conditions are known, so as long as you correct for the weather conditions, the impact on the reconstructed event geometry, which we need for anisotropy studies, is rather marginal and small for a very wide range of aerosol content. So for the anisotropy studies, we do not make any cuts on the weather, cuts that would, for example, be done for stereo spectrum analysis. Also, the analysis uses all the atmospheric databases that are built from reconstruction of the active laser shots. So, what you can see over here is the higher stereo sky above 10 eV starting December 1999. In spite of the fact that HIRES is an instrument that only works 10% of the time, you can see that this map is rather smooth. So several years of data taking have smoothed this map. You can still see that there is, during the winter, a larger amount of data at this right extension block over here than in the summer months. So I started small scale anisotropy now. The motivation for that is of course, clear arrival directions of events about 40 eV that have been observed by, for example, Agassa, have shown some hints of small scale clustering, the order of a couple of degrees, which could, of course, be the result of relatively nearby exogalactic sources and could offer some clues to the origin of these particles. The clustering is, of course, expected to be strongest at the highest energies, thus the rather high cut over here, because we expect deflections of magnetic fields to be smallest there. The problem is that this world data set, the Agassa data set basically, and the Kutz data set, have been thoroughly studied. What we need now is to test these claims of independent data. And the highest stereo detector, of course, provides this set of independent data. One slide I would like to show before I go into that. It's not clear whether cosmic ray astronomy is possible at all, because we don't know what extra intergalactic magnetic fields are and what they do to the arrival direction of the showers. This is just one computer simulation of what could happen to a 40 eV proton that reaches us from some distance in the universe. You can see here, this is a map of the expected deflection in this particular model. You can see that it's a strong function of where you are actually looking. So there are large regions of the sky where, at least in this model, the deflections are expected to be of the order of the high-res detector resolution. Other parts of the sky, there is no chance of seeing undeflected.
Is blocking cosmic rays which originated at one particular point
right
there, and then the color or the spread?
Yeah, this is the deflection they suffer on their way.
Yeah. To continue on that means when it comes, let's assume, from the SOS cluster, then we would have a 5-degree uncertainty.
Yeah. In this particular
where
model.
Where it actually comes from.
Right.
Is that the idea of this picture?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is one of the models. This is a more optimistic model of
what's the meaning of the likely magnetic field here?
I don't know.
So the blue areas are places where it won't be deflected.
Yes.
So that means that all the deflection is occurring within the cluster.
Exactly. Yeah. This visualization I will draw from this picture.
But just reflects the assumption, I guess, of the model that the fields are in the large scale structures.
Right.
The cluster fields are high and the rest is zero.
No, I just want to show this in order to see. This is not necessarily something done in vain, but you know, there are models. Make the BC fraction small.
Is there just one more picture with somewhat higher energy?
I think it's in the paper. Sorry.
Similar.
So the classic way to do this in cosmic ray data, and we'll go beyond that in the next slide, is the autocorrelation function, of course. So what you do is you count the number of pairs and p with separation of less than theta as a function of theta, as is plotted over here, and you compare that to the expected number for an isotropic scan. This is the high-risk result. As you can see, as it goes out here, there's no difference between the expected and the actual number of pairs you expect. This is the probability, and you can see the probability is well above 10% for all of these angular distances. This is the two-point correlation function down here, and you can see that there's no significant correlation seen over here. That's in contrast to what Agassa sees. These are the 57 Agassa events above 40 eV, and you can see that at about 2.5 degrees distance, we expect of the order of between 1 and 2 pairs. There is actually 7 pairs observed over here. The probability for that, as you can see over here, after accounting for the trials, is about 0.1%. Now, you can, of course, combine the high-risk and the Agassa data set, and what you see here is that in this combination of the two data sets, the probability for Agassa goes down considerably. So adding the high-risk data to the world data set reduces the clustering signal that is seen in cosmic ray data. Now, the disadvantage with this kind of analysis, and that's going to go over to another one, is of course that it's necessary to choose a minimum energy for this kind of analysis, and you have to, of course, realize that a higher energy threshold can, given the magnetic fields, reduce the deflections, but it also weakens the statistical power of the data set. So there is maybe some optimal choice for the energy threshold or an angle of separation for clustering, but we don't know where that is. So what we decided to do with the high-risk theory data is just scan both an angle of separation and energy threshold. So what you see over here is the separation angle going from 0 to 5 degrees, and here starting at 10 eV, going all the way up to 50 EV, you see at any given point over here what the probability for the two-point correlation function at that particular point is. So you can identify now the spot in the sky that has the largest clustering signal, which would be this spot over here, and calculate its chance probability. You have to, however, take the statistical penalty for this scan over angle separations and energy. So what you do is you create random data sets from the simulation that have the same amount of data, and you do this scan for these data sets, and you ask how often do I get a clustering signal that is stronger than the strongest one that I observe in this particular analysis. And the result is that the strongest clustering signal, this one over here, is about 17 eV at a separation angle of 2.2 degrees. There are 10 pairs observed over here. The chance probability for that is 1.9%. However, taking into account the statistical penalty for the scanning process, the true significance, so the chance probability to see a signal as strong as this in a random data set, about 52%. So in other words, since this is a very general scan that starts at 10 eV at a very low energy, we actually do not expect to see any clustering. That means that there's no significant clustering signal anywhere in the high-risk theory data at this point. So you might ask, whether the statistical penalty you take for scanning is too high and you wouldn't even observe it if it was there. That, however, is not true. For example, if you include artificially two pairs of events having a distance of roughly the high-risk angular resolution among the 27 events above 40 eV, your chance probability would actually be of the order of 1%. So this method is sensitive to clustering. This is a side remark. You can, of course, apply this method also to the Agassa data. What you will find is that the chance probability of The clustering signal about 40 eV and 2.5 degrees angular separation is about 0.3%. That would give it a chance probability of roughly 2.8 sigma. However, this could be a hint for small scale anisotropy or for the chance fluctuation in anisotropic distribution. What one can, of course, always do is test this clustering claim by disregarding all the data that was used to actually formulate this claim. So the claim that Agassa data clusters at this energy, above 40 eV, and this angular resolution, 2.5 degrees, was first formulated in a paper in 1996 based on data taken up to October 1995. So if you disregard that data and test this clustering hypothesis with the data that was taken afterwards, you see that the chance probability for clustering in the Agassa data set is also only about 19%. If you allow for cross-correlations with this original data set, you would still get a chance probability of about 12%. That means that both in the high-res and the Agassa data set, the chance probability in the clustering signal is rather, there's no signal. There's no evidence for clustering at small scales. Yeah?
And this is your reanalysis of the Agassa arrival directions.
Yes.
And all along, you haven't said that yet, but you claim that perhaps the Agassa energies are overestimated by 25%.
This is taking the Agassa energies at face value.
This is the Agassa energies at face value. But then when you're comparing your analysis above a certain energy and the Agassa arrival directions above the same energy,
this might not be the same physical
shift in the energy.
Yes.
It's not quite the same data.
That could be, yes. But
so
for example, mean, and we'll go back to that when we do the sign map in a minute. In order to compare equivalent data sets, you might have to, since the Agassa threshold is given by the data that I've published, you might have to lower the high risk threshold to get the same, to get an equivalent.
So have you tried that?
We have done that, yes. There's no, this is a, as you've seen, this is a scan. So it started at 10 eV. If there had been a signal at, say, 30 eV, it would have shown up in the scan. Or if it had been at 25 eV, it would have shown up. And it doesn't. There's no clustering at any energies above 10. But we'll get back to this little energy shift when we talk about that.
So in your analysis, you have the energy arrival direction and the spread of the arrival direction probability. Is there
we'll get back to that too when we talk about this.
Non-Gaussian winds, right? Non-Gaussian winds.
Yes, we'll talk about that. Let me just get over this real quick. There is a long-standing suspicion that it's a plane that goes through the nearest galaxies to our galaxy. So it's kind of an indication of where the matter around us is distributed. So it looks like this in a sky map. This is a very, very quick analysis of tests of previous claims. So once again, we count the number of events within 10 degrees of this plane and compare it with Monte Carlo expectations. For an energy threshold of 2 × 10⁻¹⁹ electron volts, the expected mean is about 17.1, we see 18, so the chance probability is about 46%. About 40 eV, the mean is 5.2, we see 5, so that's 65%. There's currently no access from the supergalactic plane. Okay, so let's get back to the non-Gaussian tails and the sky map. In order to create a sky map, we have introduced this maximum likelihood point source search, where we actually take into account the actual point spread function of each individual event. So this was done first as a way to combine the Agassa and the high-res data set, which are very different angular errors, to combine them into one sky map. I'll talk about that now, and I assume Glennis will talk about that on Thursday too. So what you need for this is both probability Q for an event that comes from that has a two arrival direction of XS and is observed at XC. So this is basically the point spread function of the instrument, and you need the expected background. This is this function over here. That's the probability distribution for the given high-res data set for any event to be observed anywhere in the sky. And you can once again see over here that it is rather smooth. However, there is this increase over here during the winter months, when the nights are long. So, What you do then is you test the hypothesis that ns events, so for any given point on the sky, you test the hypothesis that ns for n source events come from that particular point in the sky, and n, capital N, the total number of events, minus these number of source events, are background. And under this hypothesis, you create this probability density function. You take the product for all events to calculate the likelihood. And the best estimate for ns, the number of source events at any given point in the sky, is the value that maximizes L. So in practice, what you do is you do not take this L value, but rather the log of the ratio of the likelihood that you have ns events from any given point in the sky as compared to having no signal from that particular point of the sky, so compared to the null hypothesis. So L and R, this value over here, is then a measure for the deviation from the null hypothesis that there is no event at any given part of the sky. And you can do that over a very dense grid on the sky, basically creating an unbinned map of the sky. So if you do that, that is the result. So this is done for the AGASSA and the HIRIS data set about 40 dB, so for the combined data set of these two instruments. So what we've done is scan a refined grid of locations in the sky and analyze the probability, as given by LNR, that there is a point source at that particular spot on the sky. Once again, the significance, once you have found a hot spot, is then given by scanning over Monte Carlo data sets and counting the fraction of Monte Carlo data sets that have a signal that is stronger than what you see in the data. So this is a sky map. The combined AGASSA HIRIS sky map about 40 eV. You can see the hottest spot on the sky is this spot over here. That's the famous AGASSA triplet about 40 eV. So the highest value that you can see over here is LNR 8.54 for three source events, 2.9 events. There's of course a small amount of background that the likelihood takes into account. And that's the location of the AGASSA triplet. However, the fraction of Monte Carlo sets with a greater LNR is 28%. So this is not a particularly hot spot on the sky. You might ask the question now, what happens, what if...
Yeah? If this hot spot now is solely the three AGASSA events,
yes.
There are no
hypothesis. No, there's no hypothesis there. However, if you assume that there is an energy discrepancy in the HIRIS and the AGASSA data, and that the AGASSA threshold of 40 eV corresponds to something that is, you know, Angela, we claim about 30% lower. So if you go, for example, to 30 eV in HIRIS rather than 40 eV, then there is an additional HIRIS event that lands sort of on top of this cluster of three events. These are the three, in black, are the three AGASSA events with their error bars. This is the HIRIS event with its error bar. And you can see that it lands right in the middle there. The new value for LNR is 12.98 for four source events. And the fraction of Monte Carlo sets with higher LNR is about 0.5%. Now, it's very important to stress that this number, 0.5%, is not a chance probability. You cannot transform this number into any chance probability for that particular cluster for a very simple reason. Obviously, there are severe biases in this analysis. First of all, the AGASSA data set about 40 eV was picked, of course, because it serves a large amount of clustering, so there's an intrinsic bias in the AGASSA data set already. And that bias is not included in the calculation of the probability here. The other one is, of course, that the highest energy threshold has to be changed to include this particular event. So, given the uncertainty in the error and the fact that it is not yet clear or proven that the two experiments show different energies, this is another bias that is included. So these two biases imply that the 0.5% is a lower bound on the chance probability. Now, 0.5% isn't very interesting in the first place. And you can, of course, you know, try to disentangle these biases, but it is intrinsically not possible. So we claim that, and that's the basic result of this paper over here, that there's currently no evidence for a significant point source in the combined HIRIS and AGASSA set at energies about 40 or about 30 eV. Now, I mentioned this in this detail because there's a different interpretation of this data set, which you will hear about on Thursday by Glennis, and which you can also read about in her claim that this is actually a source of high energy cosmic rays. So We'll discuss this again, I assume, on Thursday. Keep in mind that this is a chunk of validity that is probably well above open files, so it's not very exciting. Can you repeat that?
What would be exciting if 0.5% is not exciting?
Well, open 5% is not exciting because it's not unbiased. So if we take, 200 more events with high-res, do the same thing again with a non-biased, with a new data set that has not been tuned, and we see again open 5 figures, I would say that it's exciting. Well, but that's not
usually you want three sigma, right? When you tell that you, without this, all this content.
Does 0.5% correspond to some sigma?
That's between 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Between
2 and 3. So, you can also do that with a scan of about 10 AD. This is the result. It's a little bit easier to see in a non-Hammer-Eider projection. Once again, this is now, again, the aggressive triplet over here. There's another high-res event just above 10 AV that comes within 2.5 degrees of this cluster. Glenn will talk about that one too. However, if you do the likelihood analysis on the whole sky and look for the hottest spot, it's actually not this spot over here. It turns out to be this spot over here, and that spot has a chance probability of roughly 6%. So there's not such a chance probability that is ignited from that. So even in the sky of about 10 AV, there's currently no indication for the point source. Okay, so we're coming to the next topic, and that's ELAC correlations. ELACs are certainly, as far as I'm concerned, one of the interesting objects that might correlate with arrival directions of cosmic rays. Now, the history of the study of correlations of ultra-high energy cosmic rays and BLRs has been somewhat controversial. What you can see over here is, starting in 2001, claims and disclaims of correlations of cosmic rays with BLR objects. So in green are the claims, and in kind of yellow are the papers that show that they can't go wrong.
I'm colorblind.
Oh, sorry about that. So we have three claims over here.
Never mind, you can ignore all of them.
We have two papers contradicting those claims and showing why they are wrong. There's another claim over here, another contradiction over here. We'll go over those claims in detail. So these are basically claims based on the Agassa and the Eclipse data set. We now have the higher data set to check each of these claims, and we can go over them now one by one. Let's start with the claim from 2001. What was done there is that from the raw catalog of AGN, the BLRs, the confirmed BLRs were picked that have a magnitude of less, an optical magnitude of less than 18, a redshift of greater than 0.1 or unknown, and a radial flux, a 6-centimeter flux, greater than 0.17 Jansky's. And this was compared to the Agassa data set about 48 EVs and the Eclipse data set of 24 EV combined. The 22 objects, 65 cosmic rays, bin size of 2.5 degrees was picked. There were eight pairs observed. The chance probability was estimated to be less than 10 to the minus 4. Now, if you use exactly the same conditions, the same, we'll redo this analysis in a little bit of the maximum likelihood method. But if you take the same fixed bin size over here, you see that there's no correlation for higher frequency. This one is not a true one, of course. It's something that's not significant. So this claim is wrong, or is not confirmed by high-res data. Take the next one. That's one from the year 2002. Basically the same set of people that claim this claim. Now we have the 10th catalog. We have no cutoff magnitude or radio flux, no cutoff redshift, but the authors take the BLRs that are correlated with egret sources. So these are 14 objects. The same data set, cosmic ray data set, is used. So 65 events, 8 pairs observed, chance probability 10 to the minus 4. You test the same thing with high-res about 24 EV. You observe one pair, chance probability 0.7. So this claim not supported by high-res either. The third one appeared in 2002. We have again the 10th catalog. The magnitude cut returns. There's no cut on redshift and no cut on the 6-centimeter radio flux. That gives us 156 objects. The correlation analysis was done with the Agassa set about 40 EV, giving 57 cosmic rays. 12 pairs were observed, the chance probability of 0.02. You redo the analysis with the higher data set about 40 EV, you observe 2 pairs, the chance probability of 0.78. So this claim is not confirmed either. Now, the next claim was based on high-res data. So this is not a claim by the Harris Collaboration, it was a claim by our governor of Tinikov and Tatsch based on published Harris data, where published means a sky map of events above 10 eV with no energies but only positions for these events given. The data set is once again this M magnitude less than 18 data set, 271 Harris events above 10 eV, not 40 eV, 10 pairs, and chance probability of 10 to the minus 3. So this is the most recent claim. We can't check that with Harris data because it's based on Harris data. But we can analyze this claim a little bit. It's first of all very important to realize that this is not a confirmation of any a priori claim. This is a new claim that needs to be tested with new data. Why is that? Well, first of all, the original correlation between the GASAS data set and this particular data set was very, very weak. It was about a 2%, without accounting for the statistical panel, it was about a 2% effect. Now, if you apply exactly the same energy threshold cuts to the high-risk data that you do to the GASA data set, which was about 40 eV, you see no cross-correlation between these VLUX and the high-risk data set above 40 eV. So only in going down in threshold from 40 eV to 10 eV do you get this 10 to the minus 3 chance probability. Also, the bin size is of course not the GASA bin size. It was lower to open 8 eV, which is also not an a priori value. So in other words, this is, again, a new claim which needs to be tested with independent data. What we can do with it, however, is first of all, we can apply the maximum likelihood technique to eliminate the dependence on bin size. So we take each of these events and use their proper error. That needs a small change in the likelihood function, where now you have to, of course, account for the different exposure at the various different locations of these VLUX, and you do that by weighting the contributions of the individual sources by the exposure at the position of that source. So this function QI, which gives you the probability for this any event being a source event, is now a weighted sum over these source locations in VLUX. So if you do redo this analysis with the maximum likelihood analysis, you find that the NR value is about 6 with a number of sources correlated with VLUX of about 8, and the fraction of isotropic simulated data sets with higher NR is about 2 times 10 to the minus 4. So as a matter of fact, the chance probability for this went down using the maximum likelihood analysis. However, it's very interesting to look at the energy dependence of this correlation signal. So as I said before, the original claim was somewhere around here, 40 eV. In this new claim, the Tinikov and Tatsch, the energy threshold went down to 10 to the 19. And that happens to be the point where LNR, or the measure of the correlation with VLUX, is a maximum, actually fairly close. So 10 to the 19 electron volts stands out as the threshold that maximizes the significance of this correlation. So now we can go back and ask, why was this threshold 10 to the 19 electron volts picked by Gorbunov et al. In their paper? Well, as I said before, this was based on a sky map that was published in the Harris paper, and they took the positions of the events from this particular sky map, which was a sky map above 10 eV, so they did not have individual energies for the events. So they had no choice in taking 10 eV. So they were extremely lucky in getting the maximum of the correlation signal over here. But you have to keep in mind that this threshold of 10 to the 19 electron volts in this particular sky map that we published was taken for no particular good reason. In this particular Harris paper, which is the autocorrelation scan that I presented earlier, this threshold was taken because it was much less than 40 eV. So we expect the signal about 40 eV, but we do a scan to start at an energy that is much lower in order to say safely encompass the energy region of interest. So we could just as well take 5 times 10 to the 18, which would have given no signal in this correlation plot. Or we could have picked 20 or 30 eV, which also would not have given a signal. So this energy dependence is quite important. Now, the strategy and the paper that we've already published on this is now that this is, of course, an interesting correlation that warrants some further studies. However, it's not an a priori claim. So what we can do now is we can investigate this correlation and come up with a new hypothesis that can be tested with the remainder of data that Harris will take. So we can do that both with the energy threshold and with the source catalog itself. So we can investigate the energy dependence of these correlations there the following thing can be said. Most of this correlation comes from events that have energies not above 40 eV, for example, but something between 10 to the 19th, so right at the threshold of 10 eV. So if you assume that these correlations are real, you have no reason to believe that these particles are actually charged. So magnetic fields, as you've seen, would probably deflect a proton primary in this energy range by many degrees. However, the correlations, as you've seen in the likelihood analysis, are consistent with the angular resolution of the detector. So we have correlations, or we suspect correlations that go all the way down to 10 to the 19 electron volts, but we would not expect particles to actually correlate this well. So if this assumption of a charged primary is dropped, we can of course perform the correlation analysis with the entire Harris data set without any energy cut. And what we get then is the following thing. This is the function, the number of source events that you get as a function of energy, basically, where these bins are picked so that in this bin over here you have the 271 events above 10 to the 19, so you can see the signal over here, and then you go down in energy in steps of 271 events. So this mark over here is roughly the 10 to the 18 electron volt line in the data. And you can see something very funny. The correlation analysis for the high-risk data below 10 to the 19 electron volt gives a chance for really about 6 times 10 to the minus 3. So the signal that is inherent in this over here comes almost entirely from the data set below 10 to the 18 at the lowest energies that we actually see. And there is no signal in the whole range between 10 to the 18 and 10 to the 19 electron volts. So you have this signal over here, and if you want to test it, for example, with an independent data set of 271 events that are just below this threshold, we actually get a deficit in the correlation. So this is a very curious result. The signal that you can see in this data set comes mainly from data below 10 to the 18 electron volts. So you can also look a little closer at the Voron catalog itself. That's a little bit of a grocery bag of sources. It's not an unbiased catalog of BLX. It is not a complete catalog of BLX. It's complete in the sense that it's a complete survey of the literature. And confirmed BLX in this catalog are marked as either BL or HP if they show a high degree of optical polarization. Now, the Grabanov claim of correlations between our data and BLX has been entirely based on this data set, not on the HPs. So they pick the BL objects, but not the HP objects. However, roughly, for example, half of the confirmed TV gamma ray sources are marked HP in this catalog. So if you, among them, for example, McCarran 501, so a classic BLX. So you expect the HP events to also correlate with this data set. And here's the result of that. Higher events above 10 eV, this is the correlation with the BLX sample only. If you include the HPs, the chance probability goes down. You take all energies. It also goes down by including these HP objects. I should also say one more thing. This magnitude less than 18 cut, which was identified by Grabanov et al. as the cut that improves the signal in the GASA data, also improves the correlation with high-res. There's no correlation between high-res events and BLX with magnitude greater than 18. So, this is all very confusing. Among those BLX are, of course, those that have been confirmed as sources of TEV gamma rays. This is a sky map of those. Some of these are visible, most of these, out of six confirmed from this map, five sources are actually visible for high-res, that's McCarran, 421, 501, these sources are, I guess, one is 344. This one is not. And you can, of course, ask what the correlation of high-res data with the six confirmed TEV gamma ray sources are. So five objects, as I've said, applying the 70-degree zenith angle cut, are in the field of view of high-res. These are the objects, and this is the result of the maximum likelihood analysis. Again, the BLX and the BLX plus HPs are listed here. These are the new results. And the TEV blazers and the events above 10 eV give a chance of really about 2 times 10 to the minus 4, and for the whole data set with no energy cut, about 10 to the minus 3. So these are all not chance probabilities, these are all a posteriori values. However, we identify two claims coming out of this analysis that we would like to test independent future data, and that is the original Gorbunov plane, now extended to those HP objects that are now included, and the TV blazes at all energies. And you may ask whether taking data to March 2006, we have a chance. This is the expected significance plotted over here that you would get after 1, 2, 3, so that's 1, 2, 3, and 4, more years of data with this hypothesis, GL and HP, with magnitude less than 18, and energies above 10 eV pick out of that. So you can see with the 2 more years of data, the analysis that I've just shown stops in 2004, so we already have 1 more year of data, and we will take 1 more year of data. We have this purple curve over here. So there's a fairly good chance that with this additional data set, till March 2006, we can get something around 3 sigma to confirm, to weakly confirm, I admit, this correlation.
In the meantime, I'm sure we'll be doing the same thing.
Yes, but for example, the TV laser in the northern sky will not be visible from Argentina. The number of BLRs in the northern and the southern hemisphere is considerably less than in the northern hemisphere. Okay, so that was all about anisotropy. A paper on this BLR correlation with no claim, obviously, but with a clear indication of what we would like to test the future data will come out in a month or so. Yeah?
Can I ask you about this BLR correlation? Naive. Why do you look at BLRs particularly?
Oh,
why not other big quasars, for example?
Yes, this was, we are kind of reacting to a paper by Gorbunov here. There are other kinds, obviously, for example, microquasars and stuff like that, that we can look at.
But the TV emission says very little about what you expected at TEV energies or something like that.
That's certainly true.
The TEV emission, as far as I understand, favors BLRs as sources because they have such a low compactness, such a low energy density of background photons.
And low reaction.
This means that TEV gamma rays can escape from such an object, and they are then nicely energy boosted and flux boosted and all of this. So for in TEV gamma rays, they are perfect sources, even though they are weak, etc., etc. But for really high energy cosmic rays, I don't understand. I would certainly not look at them. I mean, naively speaking, so I don't understand why.
I guess
people make such a noise about
that. I guess the answer is that they've tried a list of different catalogs. They didn't find correlation in any of them.
Yes.
One catalog gave them this correlation, so.
As a matter of fact, I haven't looked at that.
Which reduces further the statistical significance.
Yes.
Okay, but there's no physical
reason. No, not for me.
If you look at an additional paper that these guys have written, you will see that they tested about 18 or 20 catalogs of different objects. And this has consistently been the one that they have claimed correlation.
They looked at different types. Of course, one of them would show up that there's 2 sigma level.
No, I just wanted to know that there was a physics reason.
Yeah,
no. Well,
not a
500. I mean, if it has to be in catalog of sources where it works, low redshift TV blazers and relatives to capitals, it would be most appealing compared to, say, flat spectrum blazers of higher redshifts or clusters of galaxies, which are difficult to accelerate to such high energies. But, I mean, you could certainly make a physics argument that these sources could, in principle, accelerate to pretty high energies.
But it's mainly based on the fact that they're nearby. They're more via labs than quasars.
But they're not near enough by to, super GDK,
which is 10 to the 20th. That's of course also the additional problem that if you go to 10 to the 18, or even below 10 to the 18. It's very amazing that any correlation would be within the angular resolution of the detector.
Let me ask a question then. I mean, if they come from the jet, from some jet source, then they are energy boosted. So what we see is energy boosted in touch particles. So what you see are lower, in the rest frame of the system, there are much lower energy currents, which you actually can see.
I should also add that you can, of course, with high res, and we get into the chemical composition now, you can, of course, look at the events that are correlated with BLX and see whether the AC max, the height of the Charlie maximum, is any different from the general distribution of the Charlie maximum. So, you know, put these events, for example, these photons, and we found no difference between the X maxes, you know, the correlated events and those photons. So that's another, I guess, blow to this. Yeah, like hypothesis. Because obviously a 10 to the 18, a 10 to the 19 electron volt proton would be scrambled.
Yeah, that's the other point. If you want to use physics argument to say that these are likely accelerators, these particles are not something that you understand.
Well,
they cannot be protons.
They could be neutrons. So start with 28 eV
neutrons.
By the time it decays, it's outside the galactic field of the source.
Neutron decays after one megaparsec.
So it's now to a hypothetically 10 to the minus 16th Gauss field, and it doesn't.
No, even the galactic field would deflect it more than this.
Well, it hasn't decayed yet.
Our galactic field.
We don't know too much about the galactic field. Once you're, you know,
the galactic field in the disk.
The
galactic field in the disk.
If these are 10 to the 19th eV.
Right. It would still be more than 0.5 degrees.
It depends also on the geometry. Okay.
Okay, I mean, the bottom line that I wanted to make is that these claims have been talked about a lot recently, and it's very important to note that this is not, as it is built in the paper by Governor Bedell, as a test of an a priori hypothesis. This is a new hypothesis that now needs to be tested. There's currently no indication for correlation to BLX. What we see here is interesting, as I say, warrants, you know, future analysis with an additional statistically independent data set. But currently there's no indication for these correlations. And that's not what their paper actually claims. Okay, so let's get quickly into the chemical composition. That's another stereo result we published. The speed of the Schar development in the atmosphere, which is something that high-res can actually observe, depends, of course, on the mass of the primary heavier nuclei, like iron, inducing earlier Schar development. So the Schar maximum for heavier nuclei is higher in the atmosphere than the proton primaries. Now, that said, there is a large amount of intrinsic fluctuations in the depth of Schar maximum, so it's not possible for an instrument like high-res to decide event by event what it is that we see. So we can only make a statistical statement based on the mean Schar maximum versus energy. And that indicates not the chemical composition, but the dominant chemical composition where, for example, iron is representing heavier elements and proton are representing light elements. So what's typically plotted, well, let me first say how the energy index max is actually reconstructed. You can see over here the typical Schar profile of the Schar in the atmosphere. After we know the Schar geometry, things like scattered Cherenkov of light, direct Cherenkov of light, and things like that, that are shown down here, have to be subtracted from the actual fluorescence light, and to get the Schar maximum from this distribution. So, what's plotted then is the elongation rate, which is the mean X max as a function of energy. So what you see over here is the energy starting at 10 to the 17, 10 to the 20. This is the mean height of the Schar maximum for the ensemble of events. And the green one over here is the higher stereo data. Starts at about 10 to the 18 electron volts. And you can compare this to simulations. This is proton with different generators and iron with different generators. And from this kind of plot, you can see that the measured elongation rate shows that above 10 to the 18 over here for the higher stereo data set, there's no change in composition, and the composition seems to be predominantly light. I guess we'll get back to this topic tomorrow or on Thursday when Alan Watson will talk about the composition measurements. So what you can see over here is older data from the high-res prototype that ran before the actual higher detector at a lower energy range from 10 to the 17 to 10 to the 18, which indicated a steeper elongation rate than you would expect from a constant composition. So the conclusion here was that around this energy, the composition changes from a heavier to a lighter mix.
What do you argue this up? I mean, if you take the error bar, systematic uncertainty at that energy range, you don't know that these are just protons, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Even if I just accept your data as it is?
Yes. Yeah. As I said, this is not a measurement of the composition per se. It's an indication of whether we are we favor a lighter or a heavier composition, or whether the composition changes.
Stefan, the high-res prototype results there, have these also been reanalyzed with the different atmospheric attenuation?
No.
So the newer data has a different atmospheric attenuation correction than the older data?
Yes. Atmospheric data was not available for the high-res prototype, at least not to the extent that was available for the stereo result.
So in principle, the blue points could have an energy shift of the order of 20% if you were to reapply this newer analysis. So can we really compare the two data sets?
I want to stress the stereo result, as I said before. I think this is what you should take away.
Okay.
Do you have any comment on why that's different from the fly's eye stereo result in 1993?
No, I don't know. I was not a member of the fly's eye collaboration.
Well, the main difference is that this part of gray would be shifted to higher energy.
Well, yeah, I mean,
by factor of 3 or so.
Well, by a factor of 10. The set of data with the steep elongation rate is halfway between the iron and the protons, which are 18.5 instead of 17.5.
You know, these are quite different detectors.
And Pierre last week just said that it was a more primitive detector and not as long.
It had a photometry size of several degrees, whereas this is a 1 degree. So you know, your sampling is much higher. So I mean, these are not detectors.
But if you want to interpret the change in composition as a signature of the transition from black effects to black effects of rays, it's important to know where it is.
But this is not an energy range that high-res stereo can make. So high-res stereo starts at about 10 to the 18. So this is not a part of it. There are attempts to analyze this energy region with high-res monocular data. But in that case, you have to, of course, realize that, for example, the high-res one detector only has 0 to 15 degrees field of view. So that's a very limited range. So you get detector effects depending on the distance of the shot to the detector, which I could be told about. So that's a very, I guess, challenging analysis.
Do you use the same models for the shot development as we're using in the world device?
Yeah, I mean, the models have changed too, so, but they have been.
So it's not the same?
They are not the same, no.
Yeah, well, they have
but
changed.
But if you compare them, they're not that much.
They're not that much. You cannot count them.
I mean, there is a discrepancy between them. So.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you're showing that. But I mean, compared to the old model.
Old models.
I showed it that way because I wanted to ask, get a response from Pierre about what the difference between fly's eye and high-res is. And I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just that the models were different. And they weren't. It wasn't that as well.
Okay. This is the resolution of the high-res stereo detector in energy and its max. You see that this is energy, this is its max. The systematic uncertainty relating to the plot that we had before is about 15 grams per square centimeters in its max, about 20% in energy. This is also one of the last slides, just to update you on this. This is a stereo talk, but I will give the most recent high-res monocular spectrum over here. This is the one that's most recently published in, or submitted to Chris Matters B. This is a mixture of spectra. The dark, the black spots over here are high-res 2 monocular, which with increased statistics now ranges all the way up to 10 to the rough 10 to the 19. And the red spots are high-res 1 monocular. The high-res 2 monocular spectrum continues. That's the bottom line of the agreement of the high-res 1 spectrum that was published in Elizabeth Letters in the region of overlap. You can see over here this light blue line. That's quite hard to see. That would be a fit to a straight line of this spectrum to simply to a straight line going all the way from over here to over here. You see it has to have a degree of freedom of 114 over 37, so you can see to what extent that is explored.
The straight line is the iron stereo?
No, this straight line over here is a fit of this spectrum to a straight line.
Oh.
So to an exponential with one, with no break in the second. So if you plot, if you fit it with two breaks, one over here and one over here, you get a chi-square degree of freedom of about one. And this is just an indication that these two combined spectra, high-res 1 and high-res 2 monocular, do not agree with it. Yeah?
It seems that there's only one data point there about 10 to the 20th dB.
Yeah.
How many events does that represent?
I think about 3 or so events are in this region.
But then earlier, when you showed us your stereo, preliminary stereo sample, this, you said there are on the order of 3 or 4 stereo.
That was getting to April 2005. This data set, you put together the papers non carrying.
This goes up to when?
I think this includes 2004, but it says not. Or I guess the mid 2004.
So still, though, it seems like the numbers don't quite add up.
Well, I didn't say any number of the stereo spectrum. I didn't say what
well,
you end up
with.
Remember that I showed the
I
showed the energy distribution, but that energy distribution was not has not undergone any category cuts or cuts on weather conditions where these have. So this was not a spectrum, it was an energy distribution of the reconstructed stereo events without any quality cuts.
What are the last two lines here below the limit ones? There's no data point. Does it mean that the error goes down all the way?
Here are data points again. Yeah, it goes down all the way, right.
Okay.
This is the Gaussian spectrum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Representation of the Sagasa points is very misleading. I mean, it is being repeated over and over.
Yeah.
You have to mention at least that what they do in the last points, not here. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
You have many beams, and you have many beams with zero events. So the flux that is derived here by taking one event divided by the delta E.
I was not going to comment on the Sagasa spectrum. I just showed this because it
strongly exaggerates the difference between the experiments.
Yeah.
This is not the way the data should be shown.
No, I took this one.
Not your data.
Okay.
And with regard to your data, does it give you any particular heartburn when someone tries to fit it directly? Is there any sort of...
No, as a matter of fact, I would prefer the direct fit analysis, seeing how much of disagreement actually is with that.
There's no log convolutions that would make a better approach to fitting data?
Oh, there is. I will not go into that. That is something that Doug Bergman really talked about. He fits this particular model, but I'm just taking the data based on it. Okay, and summarize. I think an important statement to make is that cosmic rays above 10 to the 20 electrons exist. There's no doubt about that. We have some other experiments have. So high-res data, however, is currently not in contradiction with the GDK cutoff. You can always say the stereo spectrum is not in contradiction, or it is in contradiction, but since the GDK suppression is the theory you would expect, it's an important statement to make that we are not contradicting this particular suppression. The composition of our 10 to the 19 electrons is dominated by light elements. It doesn't mean it's 100% protons. It just means that the elongation rate doesn't change, so there's no change in composition, and it is closer to the predicted line convergence. The angular correlation for higher survey data about 10 to 19 electron shows no small scale clustering. If you take the world data set of Hyres and the Gauss of about 4 dB, the claimed correlation, the claimed small scale clustering is obviously reduced by that. In a maximum likelihood point source search, we find no significant point source above 10 eV or 40 eV for that matter. We'll get back to that on Thursday, I assume. As far as the BLX correlations go, there's no correlation between Hyres events and BLX in any tests of previously made claims. What we see and what has been claimed is a new claim that has to be tested with new data. And for the future, Hyres, as I said, is scheduled to run through March 2006. So as I've shown, there's a chance that we can make a decisive test of the BLX correlations. And this talk was a little bit with an emphasis on anything having to do with the Sky Network. Anisotropy, and that's of course because Hyres is currently producing the sharpest picture of the northern sky in our time in the distant race. Okay.